to start. We're going to start this board meeting with a discussion on IFRS 17. Henry?
Yeah, I'll just say a few words. Thanks very much, Hans. Good afternoon, everybody. So this afternoon, we're going to continue with our re-deliberations of the proposals in the exposure draft, and we're following the plan that we set out last November. We have another important package of papers to discuss this afternoon. In total, we've got six topics to get through. And with this package of papers this afternoon, we are bringing to an end, really, our planned discussion of the topics that you decided last November that you would look at again in the light of the feedback on the exposure draft. Except we've got two topics to bring back next month, the IFRS 17 effective date and also the temporary extension of the deferral of IFRS 9 as well. So as I said, last month we'll bring those back to your to next month's board meeting. Also next month we will bring to you the paper asking for your permission to start the balloting process as well. And so our plan still remains to finalise the amendments mid this year. So as I said, we've got six topics this afternoon. We're going to do the papers in the order that they're laid out in the package. You'll see that the team has grown, and so welcome Gustavo, who's joined the team to help us out, and he's going to kick off with the first paper on the CSM attributable to investment services. So with that, I'll hand over to Gustavo.
You hear me? Agenda paper 2A discusses the feedback on the proposed amendments to IFRS 17 relating to the contractual service margin attributable to investment services. The analysis in the paper is structured in four sections, each including a question for the board. I plan to introduce each of those questions in turn. I'll start with the section in paragraph 7 to 51 of the paper that discusses the proposals in the ED to require an entity to identify an investment return service for insurance contracts without direct participation features. Almost all respondents agree with these proposals. However, some respondents were concerned about the specified criteria for when such service may exist and the operational complexity introduced by the proposals. Based on our analysis of the feedback, the staff recommend that the board finalize the proposals and confirm the specified criteria. However, the staff recommend replacing references to positive investment return with just investment return in this criteria. In particular, the staff concluded, as proposed in the ED, that an entity provides an investment return service only when the contract includes an investment component or the policyholder has a right to withdraw an amount. Absent such features, the policyholder does not have a right to benefit from investment returns, regardless of whether an insured event occurs. The staff think that, in such cases, the policyholder receives an insurance coverage benefit that is enhanced by investment activities performed by the entity, rather than a separate investment return service. In that context, the staff also recommend that the board require an entity to include, as cash flows within the boundary of an insurance contract, the costs related to investment activities to the extent the entity performs such activities to enhance benefits from insurance coverage for the policyholder, even if the entity has concluded that the contract does not provide an investment return service. I will now pause and ask whether you agree with the staff recommendation. Thank you.
So I do agree with where the staff has landed on this. There are a couple of really important things, I think, in the analysis that you prepared for us. I think in particular, paragraph 16, where we talk about the fact that the policyholder does not have the right to benefit from the investment absent the insured event. And I think that's a really critical part of the analysis that comes out here. And then in paragraph 18, you talk a little bit further about the fact that what the insurance company is doing is enhancing the eventual service that they will supply. And I think that's an important part of the overall IFRS 17 project, is to bring it in line with the way we think about other similar circumstances, about when you recognize profit and when you don't recognize profit. And I think those two paragraphs are very important for me in just setting out the order of the way things happen. Another was just going to be important, and this is perhaps raising a flag for the drafting when we get further down the drafting process, is I think it is going to be important that we are very specific as to what it is that makes this specific expense and the extent of this expense part of the fulfillment cash flows, and not be careful about the fact that we're not implying that there are other things that might be pulled in as well.
Just building on Darrell's last point, I also agree with the staff recommendations in question one, but I did notice that in 1C we've got the words investment activities, which I think is another, as a new term, from, I don't remember seeing it in 17 before, so I support the recommendation, but when we're drafting, I think just making sure it's clear what that, those words mean is important, or if there's another word that we can use that we've already used before. But I agree with that, what you're aiming to achieve.
Any other comments?
No. Can I assume we agree with the staff's recommendation in question one?
12, 2 absent.
I will now move on to the section in paragraphs 52 to 60 of the paper that discusses the disclosure requirements proposed in the ED. The board proposed requiring an entity to disclose A, quantitative information about when the entity expects to recognize the contractual service margin in profit or loss, and B, the approach used to determine the relative weighting of the benefits provided by each insurance contract service. Respondents generally supported those additional disclosures, but a small number of respondents expressed concerns about the requirement to provide quantitative information. Based on our analysis of the feedback, the staff recommend the board finalize these proposals. In particular, the staff is of the view that requiring quantitative disclosures is justified in the context of the significant judgments required in applying the proposed requirements. I'll now pause and ask whether you agree with the staff's recommendation again. Thank you.
Okay, silent agreement.
12, 2 absent.
We'll now move into the section in paragraphs 51 to 72 of the paper that discusses the terminology used in IFRS 17. The board proposed adding a definition of insurance contract services to Appendix A of IFRS 17. The board also asked respondents whether it would be helpful to change some of the terminology used in IFRS 17, specifically to replace the word coverage and with the word service in the terms coverage units, coverage period, and liability for remaining coverage. The majority of respondents who comment on this question agree with the proposal and said that it would be helpful to change the terminology. However, the remainder of respondents were concerned that widespread changes to IFRS 17 at this stage might cause unintended consequences and disrupt implementation. Based on the analysis of the feedback, the staff recommend the board confirm the addition of the definition of insurance contract services, but not change the terminology used in IFRS 17. In the staff views, such change would be an improvement to IFRS 17. However, on balance, the potential disruption to implementation would cause the cost of such change to outweigh the benefits. I will now pause again and ask whether you agree with the staff's recommendation.
Darrell?
So I think this one's quite a pity, because I think the terminology certainly would have made the standard easier to read and easier to work with, and I think that's obviously something that we should be considering as we go through the process. I think it was a well-thought-out suggestion. But at the same time, I think I'm probably landing in the agreement category. There's just people potentially over-reading what some of the intent is around those words, and I think it's not something to introduce at this stage of the process. So I'm reluctantly agreeing with where the staff have landed at.
I also agree with the staff recommendation. I think there was a worrying over-reading of some of the proposed wording changes, so I agree that it's good to not have that happen. Also, I think it's consistent with our approach to the process overall. I think we're trying to make as little change as we can, because even if we don't intend any great change in meaning by changing a word, somebody might read more into it. It may cause some disruption that we haven't anticipated. So I don't see this. It would have been nice to have, but probably for me not at this stage. So I agree with the staff recommendation.
Okay. Can I see
Martin?
Oh, Martin, sorry.
And I also agree, and I think, Osman, many companies are half in the implementation work, and we and others have created a lot of educational material. We have THG discussion, and all we use the old words, and I think really it would kind of disrupt implementation if we half through now changing words, and people, when they read educational materials and THG materials, other staff have to always say, okay, what was thought at that point in time. So I think for the moment it's better that we don't change it.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
12, 2 absent.
Finally, Appendix A includes our comments, other comments raised by a small number of respondents, together with the staff analysis. Based on that analysis, the staff recommends no change to the proposals in the exposure draft. I'd now like to pause again and ask whether you agree with that recommendation.
Agreed.
12, 2 absent.
Thank you, Gustavo. Anne.
So, Agenda Paper 2B. This paper addresses the question of whether there should be an exemption from the requirement in IFRS 17 for annual cohorts for specific insurance contracts, those with intergenerational sharing of risks. You'll remember that the question of the level of aggregation for applying IFRS 17 has been a complex matter that the board's discussed many times. Unusually for IFRS standards, IFRS 17 does not require insurance contracts to be measured at an individual contract level. Rather, in acknowledgement of the nature of insurance activities, IFRS 17 requires an entity to measure a group of contracts. The determination of those groups includes a requirement that a group does not include contracts issued more than 1 year apart. And this requirement is a practical approach adopted by the board in response to feedback before IFRS 17 was issued, that a more principle-based approach was overly burdensome for entities to apply. When developing the exposure draft of amendments to IFRS 17, the board discussed whether to keep the requirement for annual cohorts and considered specifically how that requirement applies to insurance contracts with intergenerational sharing of risk. The board concluded that the resulting information is sufficiently useful to justify the costs of the requirement for all contracts, and so decided to retain unchanged the annual cohort requirement. The exposure draft did not ask a question on the annual cohort requirement because we were not proposing a change. Nonetheless, we received feedback from some stakeholders. Of those, a few explicitly supported keeping the requirement, but many urged the board to consider the matter again, especially for contracts with intergenerational sharing of risk. At the November 2019 meeting, the board tentatively decided not to consider further the feedback from respondents on annual cohorts for insurance contracts other than those with intergenerational sharing of risk. So this paper considers only whether the annual cohort requirement should apply to contracts with that sort of sharing of risk. The paper uses as a starting point the example that was discussed in the March 2019 board meeting, when the board considered this matter as part of developing the exposure draft. We've extended the example to consider two aspects that were not addressed in March. The first is the assumption that you need to identify the effect of sharing of risk on the contractual service margin of a new annual cohort when the entity has discretion over the sharing of the returns on underlying items between the entity and the policyholders as a whole. And the second aspect is the subsequent measurement of separate contractual service margins for each individual annual cohort. We also consider in the paper the effect of fixed cash flows. That's cash flows that do not vary with the returns on underlying items. So, for example, financial guarantees and claims. The example we looked at in March focused only on sharing of returns on underlying items and hence didn't include any such cash flows. The analysis of the steps that we think you need to apply annual cohorts when these aspects are taken into account is set out in paragraphs 15 to 22 of the paper. Overall, considering these additional aspects, we're satisfied that the requirement for annual cohorts can be applied in a way that provides useful information. However, we acknowledge that doing so can be complex and can require considerable judgment. We therefore analysed what information would be lost if we did not have a requirement for annual cohorts, and that's set out in paragraphs 23 to 28 of the paper. So annual cohorts provide two types of information. There's information about losses caused by the effects of fixed cash flows, and there's information about trends in profitability. The table in paragraph 27 of the paper identifies when the costs of applying the annual cohorts might be relatively high and when the usefulness of the resulting information might be reduced. So we think there are two features that, when combined, mean the costs of applying the annual cohort requirement could be relatively high. The first is feature one in paragraph 27, which is when contracts share risks across generations of policyholders and the entity has discretion over how it shares the returns from underlying items. In these cases, the determination of the CSM for new groups is subjective and requires judgment. If, in addition, the contracts are variable fee approach contracts, so that's feature two in paragraph 27, the contractual service margin has to be remeasured subsequently for changes in the entity's share of underlying items. Now, as I've explained, we think that entities can do this, but we do acknowledge that it's complex and requires judgment. On the other hand, we've also identified features that make the information from annual cohorts particularly important, and the features we've identified both relate to fixed cash flows. We've distinguished between financial guarantees over the returns on underlying items and other fixed cash flows, because we think that in low interest rate environments, information about the effects of financial guarantees is particularly important. So if contracts include financial guarantees over the returns on underlying items, and changes in the effects of those guarantees is not shared with other policyholders, so that the entity is bearing all of the effect of the change in the guarantee, we think the information given by annual cohorts is so important that its benefit will exceed the cost of applying an annual cohort requirement. So it's only if changes in the effect of the financial guarantees is shared with other policyholders, is mutualised, and only a small effect is retained by the entity, so that's feature three in paragraph 27, do we think that the benefit of the information from annual cohorts might be reduced to an extent its loss could be acceptable. I'll talk a bit more about what we mean by small later on. For other fixed cash flows, we think there is less risk there. So we think that if there's only a small amount that's not shared, that's not mutualised, so that's feature four in paragraph 27, then you might be in a situation where the benefit of the information from annual cohorts is lower. Well, having identified features of contracts for which it might be appropriate to give an exemption on cost-benefit grounds, we considered what the cost benefits in relation to those contracts would be, and also what the cost benefits would be for everybody affected by IFRS 17. The arguments for the cost benefits in relation to the contracts identified are set out in paragraphs 30 to 32 of the paper, and the broader arguments for everybody affected by IFRS 17 are in paragraphs 33 to 38 of the paper. There are a number of points I'd like to highlight. The first is, we think an exemption is only acceptable if we can develop a robust scope that limits it to the contracts with the features that we've that I've just described. Even for such contracts, we think the balance of the costs and benefits can be debated. For other contracts, we think the loss of information from not having annual cohorts would be unacceptable. We also know that any scope would come under a lot of pressure. It's clear from the feedback, even just to this paper, that there are many questions about which contracts have the features that we've described in paragraph 27. And it's also clear, we think, that some might assume that more contracts are included within that sort of set of criteria than we had intended when we were writing it. We think we would have to set bright lines for the scope to be enforceable. And these bright lines would inevitably be arbitrary because they wouldn't be grounded in a principle or an objective other than the balancing of costs and benefits. We've also received questions on the paper that indicate that the criteria, if we tried to draft them, that the criteria would be inevitably complex. I mean, it might sound quite simple to say, oh, well, these are the criteria and this is how you draft it. But the way that they interact and that the way they fit within IFRS 17 would mean that it would be difficult and complicated to draft such an exemption. On balance, the staff recommend not giving an exemption from the requirement for annual cohorts because we think that the risk of the scope extending to contracts for which there would be an unacceptable loss of information is too great.
Daryl.
All right, so maybe a couple of things. And firstly, just to compliment the staff, I know that immense amount of work has gone into this, a lot of research has gone into the process to get us to this paper. And I know that staff were energetic in looking at what options were available on this particular outcome or the particular answer here. I spoke to Mary yesterday. She can't be here today because she's ill. But she was quick to remind me in the discussion yesterday to remember why we came up with annual cohorts in the first place. I think the background to the annual cohorts was as a simplification, and that simplification arose because people were struggling with concepts like similar, with principles like similar, and they felt that, those types of principles would result in considerably more granularity than what many of them would have been comfortable with. So annual cohorts is already a significant simplification to allow for grouping of contracts in circumstances where you might otherwise have had to split them apart. So I think that's an important consideration as we go through the process. I also get asked the question from time to time, why is this idea of cohorts important? Why is that a... I think it's important to remember that with many long-dated insurance contracts, I think the most important decisions are being made when the contract is initiated. So things like the acceptance of that risk in the first place, the pricing that is attached to those contracts, the setting of guarantees, the impact of market competition that is relevant at that particular point in time. And then those features, you've got the uniqueness of the features like interest rates, which will change from day to day in many circumstances, which is why people were concerned about similar in the first place. Lots of other market indicators, the availability of data. So all of these things tell you that the initiation, the decisions made by the entity at initiation of a contract are critical to the way a contract plays out in the future of their contract. And so I think that is why for many of the investors, the users that we've spoken to, and I'm conscious Nick might speak after me, but for many of the investors that we've spoken to, why they place such an importance on this. And it's not just about giving an indication of the value in book at a point in time, but it also gives you some indication of what's likely to happen in the contracts that you're going to initiate in the future, because it's talking about your responsiveness to the market, what kind of market you're operating in. So those profitability trends, that onerous information, I think is really important. There were one or two little housekeeping issues from my side before I just get into something I specifically wanted to discuss. I think the first one was to say, just because I've had the question raised with me, paragraph 22, I think, touches on the fact that Appendix A is one way of doing this. and is not in any way meant to be a prescriptive outcome. And that question has been raised. So I think it's important to sort of emphasize that. We have a comment in paragraph 9 that talks a little bit about, that talks specifically about the perhaps preponderance of views that we heard out of Europe and the less views that came from other jurisdictions. And I think it's worth balancing that. We certainly heard the majority of the comments, perhaps the towards the three-quarter mark of comments came out of the European environment. Clearly, there were comments that came from elsewhere as well. But at least some of those comments in the discussions I've had from jurisdictions were in support of the European position. And so I think this, certainly not a unique European problem, but certainly more focused in the European jurisdictions. Probably not alone, but I've received quite a lot of correspondence over the last couple of days and had quite a lot of discussions with various people about this topic. And I think there have been a couple of terms that have been thrown around that are used relatively loosely that I think is worth us perhaps tightening up. For me, I start by thinking of BC 138. And BC 138 says that if annual cohorts are not going to have an effect, essentially it says you don't have to think about annual cohorts. So we know that the population of responses we're getting to this particular question and the comment letters we got are in regard contracts where there is an effect because of annual cohorts. So clearly we are having that effect. Then a lot of people have talked about the idea that there are contracts where the cash flows are fully mutualized. And by fully mutualized, they mean that that cash flows move around for guarantees, they move around for underlying performance of assets, they move around for, in many circumstances, even claims. I think what people don't necessarily go all the way through in concluding that discussion is typically, though, the entity is still one of the people who is sharing in those underlying cash flows. And let's say a 90-10 contract, clearly 90% of the risk has been absorbed by the other participants, by the other generations, these intergenerational cash flows, there's that risk moving back and forth. But that doesn't take away from the fact that 10% still resides with the entity, and that's 10% of the guarantees, it's 10% of the underlying cash flows, it's 10% of the cash that is moving back and forth to cover claims and other things. And that 10% represents all of the profitability of the entity. It is its income and expense from this. So that is important. And knowing whether that 10% is growing or shrinking over time is clearly an important indicator for how this entity is going to perform over time. I think that might be a little bit of the discussion that people missed from some of the correspondence that I got when they got into the analysis in paragraph 27. The impression I almost got from a lot of entities, and you mentioned it in your tee-up, the impression I got there was a lot of people were saying, yes, I have mutualization. Yes, I have sharing of guarantees. Yes, I have relatively small amounts that are fixed, without looking at the fact that that 10% is still a significant part of their business. And having been part of some of the discussions that went around with various parties over the last couple of months, I suspect that the group that you were targeting, 27, is far narrower than what anybody else was thinking, where the cost might be balanced or might be more in balance with the benefits. And then I think the analysis that you've done in the paragraphs that follow 27, I think a lot of people have not necessarily focused as much on. And I think that's a good analysis of why the benefits in the vast majority of these circumstances are going to exceed the costs. And then the last point I'd make is that there's been quite a lot of discussion about bright lines and why we couldn't have a principle for moving around. And I just we had this discussion at a point in time in the past when we were talking about the modified retrospective approach. And I think the problem is that when you have something that is an exception to a principle, it is hard to have a principle for an exception to a principle. You get to the point where you need to be more definitive because the principle is annual cohorts. And as soon as you start trying to subcategorize that, I think you need to get into the area of bright lines. And then I agree with where you've landed, and bright lines would have been arbitrary.
Nick.
Thank you. So users have been amongst those stakeholders who have explicitly required for the requirement for this requirement for annual cohorts to remain in place. And indeed, users have done that again in response to the exposure draft, even though there wasn't a question on annual cohorts included in there. So I think they clearly understand and they appreciate that it's a foundational element of the standard. It's a key a linchpin that, to my mind, that holds so much of it together. I found the paper very helpful in that it outlined particular circumstances where you could see an exemption would make sense, either because the costs of annual cohorts were relatively high or the benefits of using them were low. But if we simply can't scope that exemption in a manner that stops contaminating other contracts, which would undermine the standard from a user perspective, I think that's the trade-off that we're faced with. And to me, it's simply too high a cost to consider, to go there, to think all of the hard work that's gone into bringing the standard to where it is, the implementation work that's already underway, to suddenly say, actually, this starts to undermine user confidence in the outcome. It, to me, it's just simply too risky.
Martin.
Thanks, Hans. When I read the comment letters on that annual cohort, and I was convinced that maybe there are some contracts in practice where you can question the benefits to have annual cohorts. And I was also convinced that, okay, if you have a high level of mutualization, if you have a high level of sharing the underlying returns, and especially if you have a high level of discretion over shareholder share, that there may be contracts where you can really question is the benefits outweighing the cost. And therefore, I was very happy when the staff tried to find an exception. And I was also very ambitious to find an exception. But then, as long as we discussing that, and I think I was really convinced it is not possible to find really when really benefits outweigh cost and when this turn around and then costs outweigh benefits, because there is not such a case, because when there is the complex are, for example, not one level of contracts, there are mixtures of discretion, different levels, mutualization, and when is exactly when you can make the judgment when benefits outweigh the cost. For me, it was impossible. And maybe then to find even then a principle-based solution for that, I think, is not possible. There is no any objective other than cost benefits. And therefore, I think for me, it is also difficult. And then, as Dara said, we received already some letters, and people say you should find a principle-based. But people have not given recommendation what kind of principles that would be. And therefore, on balance, I think we were not able, and staff were not able, to find this kind of robust scope. And that is, for me, important, because otherwise, also, I think if we would have done it without a robust scope, I think we would have also been criticized by many people, because as we have between the general model and the variable fee approach, people said, okay, we have cliffing effects, because our contracts are similar to those which qualify for the variable fee approach, and we don't understand why we are not then allowed to use a variable fee approach and we have to be in the general model, and we cannot understand that. If we would have come with this exception, we would have a third measurement model. We have a general model, we have a variable fee, and we have a variable fee without annual cohorts. And then people would again say, okay, if you would have done the exception with bright lines, this justify why we are in and others are out, and I think that would not be possible. And therefore, overall, and I think as what you mentioned also in your preparation of that, because when I think in this low-interest environment, when I'm hearing a lot of, especially in my home country, where people saying, okay, when these guarantees are kicking in, and that is valuable information, and I think that is also where people say there will not be onerous contracts with mutualization, which is not true, because when there is a kind of guarantees are given in different levels. Maybe some contracts have a guarantee of 3%, others have 2, 1, and currently they issue contracts with 0% of guarantees. I think if you have an interest level then on different levels, I think the guarantee is kicking different in, even if you have mutualization. So this argument is also not true, and I think if we would have lost this kind of information, that would be really not a good thing, because I think that was users expecting from us, especially if we come and come with these new standards. And if we have that, and if you I read again what our objective was, and especially to get better reflection of guarantees, that was what we said at the beginning. And if we would have lost that for this kind of big population of insurance contracts, we have not done a good deal. And therefore, I'm in favor of not.
Can show.
Thank you. As Martin said, that first of all, when I look at this issue, my original impression is that, okay, current standard B, paragraph B 67 and B 68, it seems that already just this issue, because when you estimated the forfeit cash flow, the impact of those mutualization on those cash flow already considered. So this is first impression. Then I, when I look at those details of the contract, those concerns, of course I have sympathy, because once, especially for those entity has discretion of the sharing of the return of those underlying items between entity and the policyholders, it really involving a lot of judgment on assumptions, so the cost is really high. I have sympathy for that, but whether we can have any solution to those issues, I went back why we need any cohort requirement. So Daryl actually introduced the background, because I still remember when I read the first exposure draft, when we developed the proposal, try to build on the similar profitability. This is a main principle. And finally, we decided to introduce the annual cohort requirement. But the objective is clear. We are trying to provide useful information on profitability of those contracts, of the group of contracts, of insurance contracts. But if we remove that or change that annual cohort requirement, provide exemption or exception for certain contracts, of course, some useful information will be missing, particularly with regard to the information on those fixed cash flows, financial guarantee and the claims, and also the trends of in you know, profitability of some contracts. Particularly, I worry about that for some contracts, if with annual requirement, they may be loss-making contract. But without that annual requirement, those information will not be provided to the users, because it will mutualize with other, you know, contract. So those information, I think, very useful to the users, but those information will not be available for users. And secondly, whether we really can draw a bright line, I think actually when I read the paper, actually we try our best. If we are trying to draw the bright line, what kind of bright line we'll have, and what kind of issue we needed to tackle. When I read the paragraph 34, actually, there are 8 issues we needed to answer if we would like to draw the bright line. But all those issues are very difficult, how to define how much of the discretion, how to define the small, how to define the what's the significant, substantial, the sharing or something like that. So maybe we'll end up this kind of bright line, very arbitrary, you know. It's very difficult to justify, particularly if, as Daryl mentioned, we provide exceptional or additional principle in addition to the annual cohort requirement principle. But that is a basic principle, but it's very difficult to justify. So on balance, I agree with staff's proposal to keep annual cohort requirement as a basic principle, to not provide additional exception or exemption to that principle.
Gary.
Thank you. By the way, very well-written set of papers by the insurance team, and even I could understand them quite well. I agree with the staff's recommendation in this paper, but I have a little bit different approach to it. That sort of stepping back, and I look at the entire IFRS 17 project, there's 3 or 4, I call it, foundational principles that underlie the whole thing. You have 2 models. Fulfillment cash flows will always be in the balance sheet, they'll always be a current value. Annual cohorts, which I'm glad Daryl reminded me, goes back some years, it was a simplification from what we had before then. But there's a few others, but there's a few foundational things, and I think the minute you start touching one of those, unless it's truly some extraneous minutia point, I think less is more, and you should perhaps leave alone, because if they're foundational and you go into it in a big way, we have two things have to happen. One, you have to eventually reconsider re-exposure on that point, which I think is not appropriate in the circumstance. But also, two, one of the two foundational principles that we had when we went into this exposure draft, one of them was don't be disruptive to the work that's been done before. And some people, some companies, maybe a lot of companies, they've gotten through this issue of annual cohorts. So if you're going to change, whether it's a bright line or a different way to think about intergenerational risk sharing, I think we have to ask ourselves, what's the knock-on effect to those that have managed to get their way through it? You don't necessarily suggest that they should go back to what the new exception is, so you're into an accounting policy choice, is sort of the knock-on effect, as I see this coming through, if you went there. Because I think the ask here is not really extraneous stuff at the fringe. This is more central. And I think the benefits do, in fact, weigh out the costs of the staff's recommendation in there, and for slightly different reasons, but I can get to the exact same place the staff recommendation was.
I've also had a number of people who have approached me to talk about the paper, and I think I would summarise the feedback that I've got as people being disappointed with the punchline when they got to the end of the story. They liked the story along the way, but they didn't like the punchline. But jokes aside, I think what people were disappointed about or feel that it's incumbent upon us to address is the fact that we've acknowledged that there could be situations where the cost-benefit doesn't stack up, and so they therefore feel that we've almost put upon ourselves a responsibility to find a way to address that cost-benefit challenge. And so I think they're disappointed that we haven't recommended doing that, having made that acknowledgement. So I was going to talk a little bit about my thinking on this. So I agree with where the staff landed, because I think it's really important that we get, if we're going to have a line, we have to get the line right, because we know that there are circumstances, even with mutualisation and sharing of risks and all of these things, where you could really lose very important information if you don't get the line in the right place. So it's really important that we are clear about where the line is drawn. And I think we go into this discussion with our eyes wide open that there's very strong differences of opinion about where it's appropriate to draw that line. People have got really different views about where the cost-benefit trade-off tips from one side to the other, and we don't necessarily agree with some of the assessments that people are making when they talk to us. I think a lot of people also think that because we often talk about IFRS standards being principles-based, that in some way we've failed if we start to say, well, we could only do this if we came up with bright lines. They're saying, well, your job is to write principles-based standards, so it's incumbent upon you to come up with a principle. But it's very common for us, when we write exceptions, to have very bright criteria around how they're drawn. If you look at our investment entity criteria and our consolidation standard, if you even look at the criteria we use to determine the population that would be entitled to defer IFRS 9, it's a very specific rules-based sort of set of requirements that we drew within our principles-based standards. And again, it's in situations where there's a really big difference between consolidating or not, or deferring 9 or not, or applying annual cohorts or not. Whenever we're in those situations, we try to be very clear about the boundaries, and so that's why we went down that path. Now, some people might still say, well, that's not a good enough reason to give up, because you've acknowledged there is a cost-benefit challenge in some circumstances. So let's imagine that we decided to be brave and to say, well, we'll do something different in this case, even though it's very important to get the line right, and we'll say, think about the sort of things that we've got here as features, and you make an assessment of when the costs outweigh the benefits. We tried something similar to that, actually, in a very different context, and it was in the context of IES 8, when we asked people whether we should have a different set of requirements for changes in accounting policy arising from agenda decisions at the Interpretations Committee. We thought it would be a good idea to ask preparers to assess when there'd be undue cost in doing retrospective application and restatement of numbers. And my recollection is we got overwhelming feedback that that was not an appropriate assessment to put in the hands of preparers and not a fair assessment for preparers to make, because these cost-benefit judgments are we're the best people to assess them because that's our day job, and it's really hard for preparers to do it. So even if we were to take that extreme, I think we've had feedback in the past that would suggest that's not a helpful way to standard set. And so I think even though, like Martin, I started off, you know, with empathy, and I'd hate to think how many hours collectively of our lives we've spent running numbers and trying to get this to work, I do ultimately agree with the staff recommendation.
I would like to make some general comments, which is that for accounting standards to be truly solid and prudent, they have to hold up well in periods of stress. And there is absolutely, well, and look, for example, at the financial crisis, where in some parts of the world, SPVs that had been derecognized had to come back to the balance sheet because the accounting principles were not strong enough in these stressful circumstances. Fortunately, this was not the IFRS world. But the incurred loss model also did not hold up well under stress, and that's why we changed to expected loss model. There can be absolutely no doubt that the insurance industry is under huge stress as a result of the low interest rate environment. In many cases, in combinations with guarantees that were incurred in the past but that still exist. And that low interest rate environment is not a passing thing that is here to stay. All central bankers talk about low for long. So this is not going to go away in 2 years, unfortunately. Bonds will always remain very important to insurers to invest in. Now, when they invest in government bonds, in most cases, they make an upfront loss because of the negative interest rate environment. And an insurer told me in a private conversation, I don't know what to do with my premiums because I cannot do decent business if I have to buy bonds at negative interest rates. I've also been told by an insurer association in an important European country that all new VFA contracts were to be onerous if they were not subsidized by profits from old contracts. And that is a reason why their local regulator is telling them to move to unit-linked products. So there is really something going on in the insurance industry, and I believe it is tremendously important that the income statement gives information about this worsening situation. And, well, the staff has acknowledged that for highly mutualized contracts, the annual cohorts may in some cases provide less information on the profitability trends, and that new contracts may escape becoming onerous because of the possibility of cross-subsidization, such as the example that I just gave. Yet, almost no contracts are fully mutualized, and we have to be absolutely sure that any exception holds up under stress. And I was one of the board members that encouraged staff to really do their best to try to find a solution for that minority of contracts where we were confident that absence of annual cohorts would not be such a big issue. Staff could not find it, and I am satisfied that you really could not find it, not a convincing exception that would hold up under stress. Bright lines, many have said it, they tend to be arbitrary, and well, we know the discussion around this standard. They would immediately be challenged, and they, if we were to find them, they would be highly susceptible to structuring, especially in this climate where a lot of companies have serious problems. And then it's also important to realize that many insurance companies do not apply IFRS 9. They are probably sitting still on a lot of available for sale equity investments from the past, and they can drip feed that through the income statement in the future, making things look a little bit better than they otherwise would be. And I don't think that we want to take risk with a standard that would add to this possibility of earnings management. Then, of course, the arguments will be additional cost. and we have no doubt there is additional cost here. But the VFA approach, that was additional cost, additional complexity. The minute that we introduced the VFA approach, other problems needed to be solved because the derivatives used to cover the real risks in the VFA approach that were now taken out of the income statement threatened to thwart the solution. So complexity, cost upon cost, insurance industry happy to eat that cost because the end result is a more stable income statement. The OCI option, lots of complexity. And the argument is will also be this is not part of our business model. But the OCI option, for which insurance company are the changes in the discount rate not an essential part of the business model? But in the OCI approach, you can do this as if it doesn't exist. Lots of complexity, cost, a lot of cost for the investor to figure it out, loss of comparability. Insurance industry happy to eat it because it gives a more stable income statement. Well, here I am absolutely convinced, yes, there may be additional cost, but it's worth it. And I would hope that the insurance industry will be happy to eat this too because it is absolutely essential that the income statement is the canary in the coal mine. We are in a coal mine at the moment, and if there is a problem, it should be clear to the investor. So from this follows that I recommend that I support the staff recommendation. Daryl?
Well, I'm slightly nervous to come in after the chairman has had the final word. I just wanted to pick up on one or two things, Hans, that you were saying, and one or two things around the table. I think there's a paragraph in the paper 31 that is the one that specifically raises the rarity issue. I think a couple of people have talked about the idea that in some of these contracts, because of the level of mutualization, you're very seldom going to see losses actually come through, losses actually progress. But I think what the paragraph states, and I think it's right, your canary in the coal mine issue, because it is rare, it is even more important to get that indicator when it happens. And so what you essentially have is the simple fact that it's rare doesn't actually reduce the benefit. It in many ways increases the benefit of these types of points. And then I think just overall, I think there was a lot of discussion going around the table about the robustness of the test. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that because of what the objective is of annual cohorts, which is to signal these profit signals, these loss signals that are happening in the, it also implied that anything we came up with would have been incredibly narrow, and in fact probably sufficiently narrow that we wouldn't have actually satisfied the same people who are concerned at the moment about where we've landed.
Can I see who supports the staff's recommendation?
12, 2 absent.
So we move on to the risk mitigation question. So, Laura.
So, agenda paper 2C discusses the feedback on the exposure draft relating to the risk mitigation option in the variable fee approach. Some respondents continue to suggest that an entity should be permitted to apply the risk mitigation option when using non-derivative financial instruments to mitigate financial risk, in addition to when using derivatives or reinsurance contracts held. Those respondents were not persuaded by the board's rationale for not extending the option to non-derivatives measured at fair value through profit and loss. They said that for those financial instruments, an accounting mismatch can arise that is similar to the one for which the board developed the risk mitigation option. In the paper, we've considered separately the two additional adjustments to the CSM that distinguish the variable fee approach from the general model. Those adjustments are essentially switched off by the risk mitigation option, and those are an adjustment for some changes in the fulfillment cash flows, and also an adjustment for changes in the entity's share of the underlying items. The staff have been persuaded by feedback that for changes in the fulfillment cash flows that don't vary with underlying items, an entity may mitigate some financial risks using non-derivatives measured at fair value through profit and loss. To the extent it does so, and the risk mitigation criteria in IFRS 17 are met, the staff think that an entity should be permitted to apply the risk mitigation option. In contrast, we do not think that an entity should be permitted to apply the risk mitigation option to changes in the entity's share of the underlying items, so the second adjustment to the CSM. We think to do so would contradict the principle that the variable fee approach applies, regardless of whether the entity holds the underlying items. As such, we are recommending the board extend the risk mitigation option to apply when an entity uses non-derivative financial instruments to mitigate the effect of financial risk on the fulfillment cash flows, but not on the entity's share of the underlying items. The option would apply only to those non-derivatives measured at fair value through profit and loss, and would apply only to the extent that the risk mitigation criteria are met. Since we posted this paper, we have received some feedback asking the board to extend the risk mitigation option further than that. So, for example, some stakeholders have asked that it would also apply when the non-derivatives are used to mitigate risk in the entity share of the underlying items, and other stakeholders have asked that the option be extended to non-derivatives measured at fair value through OCI. So I'll now ask the board if you have any comments on this paper.
Darrell?
So, Laura, in originally reading the paper, I hadn't necessarily appreciated the... Let me just start with what I agree with and then just ask a question. So, paragraph 7, where we talk about the circumstances can exist where an entity uses physical financial instruments instead of derivatives, I definitely agree with the conclusion staff have arrived at, and I think people have demonstrated to me circumstances where that might apply, so I agree with that. I was comfortable with the point that you were making in paragraph 21 about the reluctance to extend the mitigation to the shareholder share or the entity share. I hadn't necessarily understood when I read the paper the first time that that was in fact what you were recommending, that you were recommending keeping it that tight. And I think I understand why you've got there. I just wanted to understand why we decided to do that for physical instruments while still continuing to allow derivatives to cover that particular set of risks.
Shall I? I don't mind. I'll go for an interruptive. So when we look at the derivatives, we're looking at an example where essentially an entity will potentially hold the underlying items and then buy a derivative to mitigate that risk. So you've got these two items and, you know, an explicit risk mitigation with the derivatives. With non-derivatives in the entity's share, we're talking about, you know, an entity essentially buying non-derivative financial instruments rather than buying the underlying items. And the variable fee approach reflects a variable nature of an entity's fee for all contracts in the scope of the variable fee approach. And it's a key principle that that applies regardless of whether the entity actually holds the underlying items. So we thought that, you know, having this risk mitigation to apply any time you don't hold the underlying items would contradict that principle.
We thought it would undermine the principle that you don't have to hold the underlying items in order to apply the variable fee approach, and that, in fact, you have to apply the variable fee approach if you meet the criteria, regardless of whether you hold the underlying items or not.
Thank you. Martin.
Yeah. And I have to say, when we discussed some years ago this variable fee approach, then industry were here and say, okay, that is really, you don't have understand our business model, that is all about earning a fee. That is not financial risk, that is earning a fee. And therefore, the terminal model will not reflect really our business model. And we were convinced by that, and since then we have developed a variable fee approach. But after that, we are discussing here from meeting to meeting a kind of financial risk in the variable fee approach. Which is a little bit odd.
Not all of the board is convinced about this.
But okay, we have done that, and I think I agree then, even if now companies saying, okay, if they're using that mitigated financial risk by derivatives, by reinsurance contracts, now we extend it into cash instruments. But what I don't understand is if we going so far, why are we only allowing that then for cash financial instruments which are fair value through P&L? Because if we are convinced it is a kind of risk mitigation, the instrument is doing the risk mitigation, not the accounting. And if companies using a kind of financial cash instrument which is qualifying for risk mitigation, it is qualifying. Then the second question is, what is accounting? And if we allowing that only for financial instruments which are fair value through P&L, I don't understand why. Because if we switching off the variable fee approach, we doing it going back to the general model like, and then people have the choice. They can then value the financial risk of the liability either fair value through P&L or OCI. And if then we want to, and that is what I think risk mitigation is doing to avoid an accounting mismatch, then we need both. And one option is, okay, if people then, if they get rid of the variable fee approach for financial risk, if they use fair value through P&L, maybe they have the assets, fair value through P&L, don't have an accounting mismatch, and then the financial statements would show the economic mismatch. But if people have on the liability side, then fair value OCI, then if you only allow them on the asset side, fair value P&L, they still have an accounting mismatch, and this will not show the economic mismatch if there is something. And therefore, my question is, why has the staff only thinking about this kind of, is it fair value P&L, which we're allowing this risk mitigation, and not for kind of if people do risk mitigation and their asset is fair value through OCI. Have you thought about that, or why is the reason for that?
Well, we started off with assets, fair value, P&L, because that's what the comment letters were asking for. I mean, we have subsequently thought about assets that are fair value OCI, but from my point of view, there's a number of reasons why we didn't think we would explore that further. The first is that the risk mitigation in IFRS 17 is meant to be in some sense similar to the sort of hedge accounting in the way that it's set up and structured, and you have to have documentation and you have to have this offset and all the rest of it. And in IFRS 9, you can use financial instruments, fair value P&L as hedging instruments, but not other financial assets, if I understand IFRS 9 correctly. So this would have been going beyond what we do in IFRS 9, and that's made us think that's maybe a bit dangerous. But for me, the real reason is also that if they took the effect, the financial effect on the insurance contract, and they didn't adjust the CSM, it would become insurance, finance, income and expense. And that means that, yes, they would then be able to, if they wish, apply the OCI option to it. But they would not get the same amount being recognized in P&L on the assets applying the OCI, fair value OCI and IFRS 9 to the assets, as they would get the interest expense on the insurance contract liability applying IFRS 17, unless the assets and the insurance contract started at the same time and ended at the same time, because otherwise you're going to get different interest rate effects coming through because of the way historical cost accounting works. So they wouldn't get the matching that they seem to be after if we just extended the risk mitigation. If we were going to give them the matching that I think they are after, we would have to adjust our OCI option. And then you start getting into a whole heap of questions about, what are the consequences of doing this? What would we need to think about? So, I mean, we haven't gone through that thought process, but it's not something we can just say, oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
So, are you going to respond to this? I was going back to the simpler question.
Okay. So, Martin, I probably went through something of a similar thought process, because it did seem like a relatively simple extension of where we were in this particular paper. But having thought about it a little bit more and having talked to the IFRS 9 team to just understand why they took the approach they did, I think it's probably worth saying at the first instance, the risk mitigation model we've built is by design not a free choice. So you don't have a free choice of simply moving between the models as you like. There is a process in place, but that process in place is by design very simple. We may even argue sometimes in the middle of the night that perhaps it's too simple in terms of the way we put it together, but it is by design very simple to allow entities to justify that they're in that space. And we were comfortable, I think, or personally at least, I was comfortable with that simplicity because one of the governors that I thought was in place was the fact that you would have to, an entity would have to wear their ineffectiveness. They would wear their ineffectiveness because a change in the fair value of the asset they were holding as the risk mitigant would go to profit and loss. The change in the liability that was being remeasured would go to profit and loss. And to the extent that they had not had a particularly well thought out or not particularly effective process, you would see that directly in profit or loss. The problem is if we now extend this to OCI, then that ineffectiveness ends up going to OCI unless we build a whole new element onto this model which says, well, now this is how you've got to account for ineffectiveness and what you've got to do to recognize it. And I think that, above anything else, just for me, adds a lot of additional complexity to something that was designed to be simple.
I was going to go back to the far simpler question in the paper. And say that I agree with the staff recommendation. I think it's, for me, a relatively natural extension of the risk mitigation option because the design for that was in circumstances where you were mitigating risk with something that was remeasured through P&L, enabling that offset to occur by sort of turning off the VFA approach. So it seems like a relatively natural extension. And in the same way that with IFRS 9, we concluded that if somebody was using an instrument that was measured at fair value through P&L and they were sort of mitigating risk or the specifics of 9, that it would be equally applicable to be able to use the approach. I think it sort of follows from the scope of 9 to do something similar here. And I said as a relatively natural extension, as I said. So if people are mitigating risk using these instruments, then fine by me if they use it.
Okay. To you?
The vote? I think we can take a vote, sorry.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. Do we agree?
12, 2 absent.
Move on now to the minor amendment package, so, Roberta.
Okay, thank you, Amisor.
It doesn't reflect upon you.
Agenda paper 2B is about the minor amendments proposed in the exposure draft. Overall, respondents expressed support for the proposed minor amendments. However, some respondents expressed concern or asked for clarification about the proposal that are listed in the table on page 3 of the paper. There are 11 in total. So most of these amendments would normally fall within the scope of the board's annual improvement process, but last year the board decided to address them in the exposure draft of the amendment to IFRS 17. The staff recommend finalizing all the minor amendments proposed in the exposure draft, but with some changes for 4 of the 11 amendments discussed in the paper. So with reference to the list on page 3, for amendments number 3, 7, and 11, the changes recommended by the staff are improvements to the wording used in the exposure draft to address feedback from respondents. For amendment number 5, the staff recommend extending the amendment for the investment components to loans to policyholders so that the contractual service margin is not adjusted for changes in fulfillment cash flows arising from differences that relate to the time value of money and assumptions that relate to the financial risk, which is a clear principle in the general model. Since this paper was posted, we have received feedback for amendment number 9, which is consistent with the feedback that has already been considered in this paper, as discussed in paragraphs 55 and 56 of the paper. The paper includes only one overall question for board members, which is set out on page 23, and asks whether you agree with the staff recommendation that I've just summarized. For the discussion of this paper, we suggest that you refer to the order of the topics in the table on page 3 for any question or comments that you might have on a specific amendment. And then, depending on the comments, we will then decide whether to call for one vote covering all the topics or separate votes for separate topics. And with that, I hand over to the board for the discussion. Thank you.
So on proposed amendment number 9, this is the other thing where I've had a flurry of conversations and interest from people who wanted me to be aware of their strength of opinion in terms of this proposed change to the standard. And so I've spent quite a bit of time with these people understanding, you know, why they take it so seriously and what the implications are for them, and they're certainly strongly of the view that this is, that this is a significant potential disruption to the implementation and very costly. And for some of these people are very advanced in the implementation, so they feel very strongly about it and probably feel that it's a bit rough for us to talk about trying to minimise disruption and then to turn around and propose something like this. So I'm not without empathy for their position. It can't be a great position to be in. So I particularly feel empathy for people if they have genuinely misunderstood this part of the standard when they've gone through their implementation. But I think for us not to do this correction now, when we know that at a minimum we've got differences of opinion in the market, and such an important area as determining whether you're in or out of the scope of the VFA approach is something that I don't feel we could do as a board. And so I do support the proposal to proceed with this amendment. And for me, I think, while it's not determinative, it would certainly be something I would have in the back of my mind to be thinking about when we get to the effective date discussion, because I think it becomes a something that's relevant to thinking about the effects on implementation timetables of what we've been looking at with the amendments.
Daryl?
I had a couple of comments, but let me start with the topic 9 one, I think, B107, because I think Sue's picked up on that. Firstly, I agree with what Sue said, that it is something we need to address, and I think it created a problem. But even putting that aside, I think the words of B101, 102 are very clear where the focus of this should be. And as much as Sue says we're creating disruption now, I suspect we might be creating disruption now that would have in any case occurred later as people really got into understanding exactly where those words were taking them. I also think, to be perfectly honest, that the cat's out the bag now. We've made it pretty clear how we think these words look. The feedback that I've had in the various conversations that I've had is a little bit of a realization from people that, yes, the words are leading you down that particular direction. And therefore, I think even if we were to decide to do nothing, I suspect this would still be coming back to all of those entities who've interpreted it the other way. So I support where the staff has landed on that particular one. That said, I have heard some comments coming out of what people think the repercussions are of this particular change. I know the staff has done a massive amount of work in getting to understand this issue, in getting to terms with it. And I'd probably describe the comments that I've had ranging from the just off where we are likely to land all the way to what I'd probably describe as slightly crazy interpretations of the outcomes of. And what I'd probably say is I think it would be worth you thinking about whether or not some of that work that you've done in the background could be shared as educational material or something along those lines, because I think it would be useful to just help people work through or think through this particular process and understand, to say, at least we might be able to get them back from some of the crazier ideas that seem to be out there at the moment. I wanted to comment on one or two of the other ones. I think, which is the I've got to line up my paragraph numbers here with yours. So number two, the proposed amendment to paragraph 28, which talked very specifically about which cohort a transaction goes into when there's a difference between the issue date and the recognition date. I think when we were talking about cohorts, I mentioned that for me, the most important decision date is the date on which you write the contract because of pricing, because of market conditions, because of the acceptance of risk, because of all of those things. And for that reason, while I accept that this is going to be in some circumstances a requirement that's going to cost a little bit of thinking, I think it is critical that you are grouping like with like. And I think that's what this does. So I think it is an important place where staff have landed. And then on the topic three, the B1281, and I know we'll come back to this in a later paper, so I'll start now and probably come back to the same discussion a little bit later. So the topic three, the B1281, is about the circumstance in which you have a set of participating contracts that are participating in underlying contracts. And in this paper, you're dealing with the presentation issue around that, and the question is whether you should offset the presentation, essentially. My view very strongly here is that the approach we've taken throughout 17 is to say you've got two separate groups. The underlying contracts do what the underlying contracts do. To the extent to which somebody else is participating in their risk, the extent to which somebody else is not participating in their risk is irrelevant to understanding the economics of those underlying contracts. And I think anything we try to do with the underlying contracts would be unnecessarily complex, because what it would essentially do is it would start to say that you have underlying contracts switching in and out of categories depending on something that is unrelated to them. I think equally from the participating contract, I think you've got the situation where the participating contracts are participating perhaps in these underlying contracts and in a bunch of other things. So treating that participation in a common way is important. And so for me, as a starting point, I think the way you've landed is the right answer. I think it best reflects the economics of the two different sets of contracts and how they operate, and that will leak over to the discussion of measurement a little bit later too, I think.
Any other comments? Can we vote on the recommendations as a whole? Yes.
12,
2 absent. 2E. 2E transition.
So, agenda paper 2E discusses additional specific transition modifications and reliefs that are suggested by some respondents to the exposure draft. In November last year, the board decided it would not consider further general suggestions to permit an entity more optionality or flexibility on transition. However, it said that it would consider suggestions of additional specific modifications and reliefs that could further ease implementation. This paper includes 18 topics for which respondents suggested additional transition modifications and reliefs. The staff are recommending the board amend IFRS 17 for three of those topics, as set out in paragraphs 21 to 23 of the paper. I will introduce and ask a question for each of those three topics separately, and then after that I will ask whether you have any comments on the other topics in the paper for which the staff are not recommending amendments to IFRS 17. So that's all topics other than 2, 17 and 18. So starting with the first staff recommendation, which is for topic two on investment contracts with discretionary participation features. IFRS 17 requires a number of different assessments at the inception of an insurance contract. On transition, reliefs are available so that an entity can make those assessments using information that's available at the transition date. The staff are recommending the board extend that relief to also include the assessment of whether an investment contract meets the definition of an investment contract with discretionary participation features in IFRS 17. Staff think that not including that assessment in the relief was an unintentional oversight. So I will now ask the board if you agree with the staff recommendation on topic two, which is question one in the paper.
Do we agree?
12 to 12. Okay. So So then moving on to the second staff recommendation, which is topic 17, and that relates to the proposed amendment for reinsurance contracts held when the underlying insurance contracts are onerous. The board tentatively finalised that amendment in December. As a consequential amendment, the board proposed a modification in the modified retrospective approach. The proposed amendment, including the transition modification, applies only to reinsurance contracts held that are entered into before or at the same time as the onerous insurance contract. Some respondents have noted that an entity simply may not know retrospectively whether the reinsurance contract was entered into before, at the same time, or after the insurance contract. As currently drafted in the exposure draft, that entity would be prohibited from applying the modified retrospective approach. Therefore, the staff are recommending the board amend IFRS 17 so that if an entity does not have the information to identify whether the reinsurance contract was entered into before or at the same time as the insurance contract, the entity would not calculate a loss recovery component for that reinsurance contract on transition. I will now ask the board if you agree with the staff recommendation on topic 17, which is question 2 in the paper.
Can I just confirm, Laura, when you say the entity does not know, by that we mean it is impracticable for it to get the information?
Yeah, it does. It's the sort of standard language it would be in the modified. It does not have the reasonable and supportable information.
Do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
12-2. So the third and last staff recommendation in the paper is on topic 18 and relates to interim financial statements. Last month, the board tentatively decided to amend IFRS 17 to require an entity to make an accounting policy choice as to whether to change the treatment of accounting estimates that were made in previous interim financial statements. The staff note that if an entity chooses not to change accounting estimates made in interim periods, that choice might be difficult to apply retrospectively. Therefore, we are recommending the board add a modification to the modified retrospective approach. That modification would permit an entity to determine transition amounts as if it had not prepared interim financial statements before the transition date. So I now ask the board if you agree with the staff recommendation on topic 18, which is question 3 in the paper.
Okay,
so we've covered all three of the questions.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've covered all three of the questions for the board in the paper. I would ask if you have any comments or questions on the other topics in the paper for which we didn't recommend any amendments to IFRS 17.
Daryl has been very diligent.
A couple of points. I guess as a starting point, I'd really hope we could get more in, but having gone through the detail with you beforehand, Laura, I'm happy with where staff have landed. I did think there were a couple of points that we might want to pick up and just make sure we've emphasized in the basis when we get to that point. The first one is the discussion around use of estimates. I think there was acknowledgement from people reading the exposure draft that the basis was very helpful for them to broadly understand. I completely agree with the staff view that we shouldn't be dragging the word estimates into the standard itself, because it almost corrupts every other place that we don't use the term estimates. But I would suggest, as I think is touched on in paragraph 11, that we try to carry forward the words on estimates that were in the exposure draft into the standard if we can, because I think those were helpful to a lot of people.
Into the standard or into the basis?
Into the basis. And then the other thing that I thought was really useful in this was the paragraph 18 discussion around the use of other information and how we clearly expect that people will rely on information they have lying around for completely other reasons if that information is fit for purpose, and also why we can't just kind of rubber stamp any particular type of information. But I thought, generally speaking, that discussion was useful. It felt a little bit obvious to me having gone through it. But I think it's something that might well be useful, and I think if we can get something like that into the basis, that might also be helpful.
Okay.
No question on that one.
And the final paper, Vitalina.
Agenda paper 2F, other topics raised by respondents.
At the November 2019 board meeting, the staff explained that we plan to discuss with the board the new concerns and implementation questions raised by respondents in their comment letters, so that the board could decide what, if any, action is needed to address them. Accordingly, paper 2F discusses these matters raised by the respondents on topics that were not specifically included in the exposure draft. The staff analysis in this paper is focused on the topics presented in the first and second sections of the paper with regards to the treatment of the policyholder tax and specific cash flows in the variable fee approach. The third section of the paper discusses other topics included in the Appendix A to this paper. Overall, in this paper, the staff recommend amending only the requirements for a policyholder tax to resolve a contradiction highlighted by respondents. I will now introduce each section of the paper in turn. The first section of the paper, in paragraphs 4-17, relates to treatment of policyholder taxes. In this paper, the staff describes policyholder tax as a tax that arises, for example, when an entity pays income tax on assets that are underlying items to insurance contracts, and then charges the policyholder for its share of that income tax. The staff note that there is an inconsistency in the treatment of policyholder tax that arises because of conflicting requirements in paragraph B66F and paragraph B65M of IFRS 17. Paragraph B66F specifies that an entity does not include in the fulfillment cash flows income tax payments and receipts unless the entity pays or receives them in a fiduciary capacity. In contrast, paragraph B65M requires an entity to include in the fulfillment cash flows any costs specifically chargeable to the policyholder under the terms of the contract. Therefore, the staff recommend amending paragraph B66F of IFRS 17 to resolve an inconsistency between that paragraph and paragraph B65M of IFRS 17. After that amendment, an entity would apply paragraph B65M of IFRS 17 to include in the fulfillment cash flows the income tax payments and receipts that are specifically chargeable to the policyholder under the terms of the insurance contract. Question 1 is set out on the page 6 of the paper, and I will now hand over to the board for the discussion of the topic.
Okay, all vote. 12.
I'm moving now to the second section in paragraphs 18-25 of this paper on two topics related to the treatment of specific cash flows in the variable fee approach. The first topic in this section relates to the application of the requirements in paragraph B113B. Some respondents suggested permitting an entity in the variable fee approach to reflect in profit or loss or other comprehensive income the changes in the effect of time value of money and financial risk, not arising from underlying items, instead of reflecting those changes in the contractual service margin as currently required by B113B in IFRS 17. In this respondent's view, this would allow entities to match those changes with the changes in the backing assets that an entity recognizes in profit or loss or in other comprehensive income. The second topic in this section relates to contracts that change their nature over time. Some respondents suggested permitting an entity to change from the variable fee approach to the general model when a contract changes its nature over time. An example of such a contract is a contract with a participating savings phase that provides the policyholder with an option to subsequently convert the account balance into an annuity at a guaranteed rate. We've been told by the respondent that such a contract will normally meet the criteria of variable fee approach at inception. Applying IFRS 17 requirements, an entity will have to continue applying the variable fee approach during the annuity payment phase of such a contract. The staff observed that different respondents favor different suggested ways of amending IFRS 17 to resolve these concerns. However, some of the respondents' suggestions, for example, to provide an accounting election to separate some components of an insurance contract, or to make the requirements in paragraph B113B of IFRS 17 optional, touch on key aspects of IFRS 17. Accordingly, the staff recommend retaining unchanged the requirements in paragraph B113B of FRS 17 and not adding any new requirements to FRS 17 for the contracts that change their nature over time. At the same time, the staff observe that the recommendation in the agenda paper 2C that we've just recently discussed to extend the scope of risk mitigation option for the non-derivative financial instruments that are measured at fair value through profit loss would, to a certain extent, addresses some concerns of the respondents. After the posting of this paper, we have received some feedback from preparers in various jurisdictions. The feedback acknowledged that expanding the risk mitigation option for non-derivatives, as suggested in paper 2C, would partially address their concerns, but the preparers continue to ask for further changes, for example, making changes to the requirements on the contract boundary. The staff hold the view that such changes would unduly disrupt implementation and increase the complexity of the standard. Question 2 is set out on page 9 of the paper, and I will now hand over to the board for discussion.
Carol?
So I'm starting to feel guilty about it. So I really struggled with this topic because I do have sympathy with where preparers are coming from on the issues that they are experiencing here. I think it's worth saying that in some ways we see this as a single issue, but it's actually got multiple facets to it, multiple elements to it. My starting point in thinking about this one was going back to the exposure draft that we had a couple of years ago that went into the whole idea of mirroring and how mirroring would work. And what we heard as a very clear response back to that exposure draft was the fact that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for a number of contracts to actually split the cash flows between the different drivers or elements of cash flows, because they were essentially integrated cash flows in these contracts. Now, I expect, based on the feedback that we've got, that people are saying, well, sometimes they can and sometimes they can't. The problem is that sometimes they can, sometimes they can't means that any solution we were to think about in this space would have to be an optional solution, because we would have to allow for the people who want to change and at the same time allow for the people who don't want to change. And so that already creates a significant potential difference in outcomes. And then to your point about these things going quite deep into what the model is. So if we think about something like contract boundary or separating out components, I think what it's about is not simply saying, well, for that type of contract we say you can, because we need to be more generic than that. And so we run into some of the same concerns we had when we were talking about annual cohorts. Is once you open the door a little bit, there's a lot of other contracts that potentially come through, and it becomes essentially what amounts to a free option in either the splitting contracts or the contract boundary type discussion. And I think those are two very core elements of the underlying model that would become a lot more gray in terms of how you think about it. Thinking about paragraph 113B as another option, I think runs very much the same risk. Again, it would need to be optional, and again, it would be very difficult for us to specify which contracts we mean, so we'd essentially be making it a free option and saying, you decide. And I think that introduces a lot more uncertainty, a lot more inconsistency into the model than we would like. And then I think it's worth saying, for me, in the discussions I've had, and perhaps that's why I'm talking so much today, is I've had a lot of discussions with a lot of insurers over, I guess, the last 3 months on these various topics. I certainly haven't heard a consistent view of which of those three people would prefer. And in fact, I've heard some people being very adamant about which solution they want and not taking a view on the other ones. Providing additional guidance, I think it sounded like a good idea at a point in time, but I take the point that a lot have made is that it, again, has perhaps unintended consequences in terms of the way people think about it. And I think we'd be looking with that guidance to steer people in a direction that might be different to the direction they've taken. So we kind of land with the risk mitigation option. Now, the risk mitigation option is an option, like the other options we've got, but it's an option that has got some gating on it. And I think that gating kind of helps. So I would certainly urge people to have a look at that and see what they can do with that option and how it would work. But all taken, I don't think we can open the model further. I'm comfortable with where you've landed from a staff perspective.
Okay. Take a vote.
Who supports the staff recommendation?
12, 2 absent.
Last
section of the paper in paragraphs 26, 28 discusses all the topics that are presented in Appendix A of this paper. The staff know that at this stage, further changes to FRS 17 are more likely to disrupt rather than help the implementation process. Therefore, the staff thinks that no action is required by the board in respect to the topics included in Appendix A in particular. Participating contracts with underlying items that are non-participating contracts, guidance for specific areas of the standard, for example, including reinsurance contracts held and premium allocation approach, requirements for reinsurance contracts held in paragraphs 86B of FRS 17. And question 3 is set out on page 10 of the paper. And I will now ask the board if there are any questions on each of the topics.
I promise this is the last time I'm going to say anything today.
You'll get a medal.
You previewed this.
So I think I previewed this one. So it's just the B128 issue. And I think it is important that we are accounting for the underlying contracts the same as all underlying contracts. We're accounting for the participation features exactly the same as all participating features. I think IFRS, in its broadest sense, is a mixed measurement model. And from time to time, these things come out. And that's what it is in this. I think it would be really complicated. It would add a significant amount of complexity to the standard to try to define changes in measurement every time your percentage participation change and as those changes evolve through time. And I just think it's with the best will in the world, it's just adding far too much complexity.
Any other comments? No.
Cool. Questions?
Well, do we need to vote? Do we agree? No change needed. No further
12,
change.
12, 2 absent.
Okay. All right, that brings us to the end of today's discussion. Thank you very much.